I'm now on officially. So I'll repeat Carl's welcome to Many Rivers Books and Tea. I started the store, and with a lot of help, including that gentleman, Stuart. My husband over there, Stuart, but others as well in the audience. But anyway, this is sort of a deja vu event for me, because the last time we had this many people in the store was the last time. he just told me just earlier that the last time he did a book event was in this store. for the Revelations of the Aramaic Jesus book.
No, that was before. It was for these little Gibran books.
Oh, right. That's right.
Yeah, I did.
It's a good rhythm,
but you've got a history and
I have a history. Yeah, don't tell anyone
to maintain. And have you brought some of the Scottish weather with you?
I did.
That's what I thought.
I talked to my wife today. This is exactly the Scottish weather that we're having at home. So you can blame me.
Summer Scottish or
summer? This is summer.
This is summer.
Yeah. Natural air conditioning.
So I first became acquainted with Neil indirectly because my teacher, whose picture is up in the wall back in the corner, helped was a nonprofit attorney who helped our speaker tonight incorporate the Dances for Universal Peace.
That's correct.
So that was the first contact that I had, but there has been a lot. There have been a lot. Obviously, multiple events that I don't even remember, as you've reminded me just now. But anyway, he is a remarkably skilled. This new book. Let me just speak about.
Here's
the book.
Well,
no. We've got these ones here, ready to be sold. This book is a follow up. To the one I just mentioned a moment ago, which the other copies of which we just sold out earlier today, so that's a pleasant coincidence. In any event, 40 days of contemplation and revelation. I don't know that a lot of publicity is given to that subtitle on the book, but I can testify, having already perused the pages, that this book has. A real hidden strength that I didn't at first anticipate. So I'm looking forward to this talk. I know that he can do it up just great, and so I invite you all to join me in welcoming Neil Douglas Klotz to Many Rivers.
Thank you, Rob. Thank you, Stuart. Thank you, new guys. Esfata. I hope it continues. Yes, so as I was saying last time when I was here 5 years ago, it was a whole different time before COVID, which delayed me coming the next time, and then I had some surgical interventions, which delayed me coming another time. But anyway, here I am. I'm fulfilling my purpose and my promise to come, and I'm here. So, in the meantime, with all these things in between, the visitors from Ohio. I took the time over COVID to do another couple of books. And one was Revelations of the Aramaic Jesus, which is not here, but you can find it. And that in that book, I tried to collect everything that I had done about Jesus and Aramaic, his native language, over about 40 years. Okay, so, just so we're clear where we're starting, I'm talking about the Jesus that is before Christianity. All right, I know I use this catchphrase a lot online now. It's the name of a famous book, actually, by a Dominican, Albert Nolan, but he didn't have all the resources that I have linguistically. So, but this is about Jesus before Christianity. So if you want to know what I think about later ideas of Jesus, you can ask later. But anyway, I tried to put everything that I had done in the previous 40 years in that book in a different way. There are reasons why I wanted to do it in a different way. some of which were practical and some of which was because I had simply done a lot more research, done a lot more meditation, which always go together for me, and I can explain why in a bit, and I put it in the whole package. In my previous books, I do a lot of, previous to that book, a lot of unpacking, unlayering, untranslating, mistranslations of Jesus, or misunderstandings, even if they're not mistranslations of Jesus' words, but they're misunderstandings. These misunderstandings are clarified when we look at whatever he might have said in his native language. Okay, so more on that later. Now, that book, Revelations of the Aramaic Jesus, has a lot of Aramaic in it. I had to twist my publisher's arm even to publish that book. And I only was able to do it because I'd already done 6 books for them, most of which were editing jobs. I've also worked as an editor. So I said, you know, I've done these books on Jesus in Aramaic. They sell quite well. The first one still sells, the little one. We won't mention the publisher. And they said, okay, we'll let you do it, but you can't put Aramaic on the cover. No one will buy it if you put Aramaic and Jesus on the cover. This was in 19... When did I write the book? When was COVID? 1920. Yeah, all right. I'm really old now. So, but yes, so I did eventually talk them into making the book Revelations of the Aramaic Jesus. And surprise, it flew off the shelves, actually, because that book is not only a complete picture of what Jesus said and did, no matter which gospel you look at, although I've done more work since then, but also it's, I would call it, an exposition of how human consciousness had developed over thousands and thousands of years up to his time, and how he predicted, and I think quite accurately, the way human consciousness would go unless we turned a corner. And so he points out the pitfalls of the way human consciousness is developing, the pitfalls being both towards more individuality in terms of our sense of myself as an I, as a me, but also what goes with that is a sense of separation from other human beings, a sense of separation from the natural world, which was presumed in the ancient world and is still presumed in the few, you could say, native traditions that survive more or less untouched from Western culture or so-called modern culture. So a sense of separation, and also increasingly a sense of, once we have an individual self, okay, I'm all alone, so all that matters is me. So what I called in one of my books a trend, a less than positive trend towards a more selfie and selfish culture. Huh. And Jesus predicts that, I would argue. And I think he predicts it quite accurately, but he also shows a way out. And he's not the only one, but he stands at a certain point in the trajectory of this ancient consciousness, which starts when does human consciousness arrive? 100,000, 200,000 years ago? You can read, you know, different authors about this, and but it would say at least 200,000 years ago, the sense of an individual self arises. And I would agree with this in terms of the different authors who have pointed this out. Jean Gebser, the French philosopher, Owen Barfield, the English philosopher, these sorts of folks who talk about evolution of consciousness, and not only them, but of course Rudolf Steiner, who Owen Barfield, an English friend, English scholar, and friend of C.S. Lewis, relies upon for a lot of his meta-theory, if you can use those terms. So I do recommend also Steiner's work on the evolution of consciousness. If some people here are still reading Steiner or into Steiner, I want to make that acknowledgement also. Now, I wasn't aware of these three authors that I just mentioned. I was aware of Steiner a bit, but I was not aware of them until COVID. And I had more time to read and more time at home, which was good. And I was looking like, wow, you know, I'm reading Barfield. It's like, this is all the stuff that I discovered in 40 years of working with Jesus of Aramaic. It reaffirms everything. Now, these authors don't know Aramaic. They're using other languages to come to the same conclusions. And so you can sort of see, oh, okay, there's another validation. Now, what do I mean by this? I'll get onto this book in a bit. Oops. Well, there's that one.
Discount.
That one's baptized. No, don't put it there. Yeah, you can. That could be a special, you know, double the price.
It's been baptized.
Baptized. Jesus is Aramaic, as many of you know, because I know some of you read my books. It does not make a distinction between body, mind, soul, and spirit. Okay. It does not make a distinction between inside and outside. That is, between what we're talking about here among us and what is within me. Okay, this is a remnant of very ancient archaic consciousness, where basically there is not much inside-outside separation. And that means, again, as one person wrote about, it's in those ancient, very ancient times, this is even before Jesus, maybe 100,000, 200,000 years before, it's as though we are wearing our subconscious on the outside. Our outside life is more like a dream consciousness. And at the same time, what goes with that is a sense of being embedded within nature. Again, to quote a metaphor that's used, it's as though I'm wearing nature like my clothing. So when you would touch my clothing, you know, I feel that you've touched me, not directly, but you've touched me. So when people would touch nature or be touched by nature, they would feel as though it's touching whatever sense of themselves they have at that time. And again, it's rather rudimentary compared to what we have today. But again, it's hard even to imagine this today. A tree is not a tree. A tree is not a piece of lumber, potentially. A tree is not only has a beingness to it, which different cultures explain as nature spirits, devas, you know, all the different, depends on which stories you go by. This was people's way of experiencing life and their life in nature at that time. So not only those things, but that touching nature was like touching a part of yourself. Or when you touch nature, you touch part of yourself. So why was there all this respect for nature in native cultures? Well, that's why. I mean, that's the other level of that. It wasn't just a sense of, you could say, how would we say, mythology. These were not stories people made up until Western science could tell them what really was. This was their way of perceiving and experiencing life. Now, in the scholarly world, in which I played for quite a number of years, play is the operative term, this way of knowing, way of understanding ourselves within our surroundings is called epistemology. It's called way of knowing. Along with that goes cosmology, our place in the cosmos. Both of those are big ology words. Okay, you get a PhD if you know how to use them properly. I did get a PhD, and I spent a number of years in the scholarly realm trying to convince people, particularly biblical studies scholars, that they're translating late 19th century, early 20th century, late 20th century ways of knowing and cosmology back into ancient texts. I failed. I largely failed, I would have to say. I became the head of the mysticism group of the American Academy of Religion, which is about as far as I could go at that point. And there was no mysticism in the mysticism group. We juried papers, academic papers about mysticism, and as I was mentioning to a group last week, when I was the chair of the group, the American Academy of Religion tried to put the mysticism group out of business because they argued that mysticism didn't exist. Mysticism did not exist. It may still happen. I quit. You know, I retired after 6 years. I'd done my bit, and I did save the group at that particular time by using postmodern, you could say, language to deconstruct their arguments and to make a case that we were a conversation place where, you know, different conversations go on, as Derrida talks about, and So blah, blah, blah. So, you know, so I learned to speak scholarly. It's another language. It's often there's not much there, to quote Gertrude Stein. That's how it is. So Not as cool as Aramaic, and I gave up writing scholarly papers and decided I just go back to writing for people. So I do my best. I did get some complaints that Revelations of the Aramaic Jesus was way too dense for most people. It has a lot of Aramaic in it. Some people love that because they want to know what each word means, because they've been told it meant something else. So for the people who felt it was too much Aramaic, I wrote this book. And this is sort of the homeopathic dose of the Aramaic.
And
it's based on an earlier book I did in the Sufi tradition called The Sufi Book of Life, if some people have seen that, which is meditations on the Asmaul Husna, which are the 99 beautiful names. So as an ancient Semitic sort of generalist, if you will, I also did some work, quite a bit of work in that field. And that's also a very good book. But so this is modeled on that. So 40 short chapters, a few words of Aramaic as seed words for your meditation, a thought, a contemplation, you know, what are you experiencing today, and what might Jesus, Yeshua, have to say about that? What might he have to say? Again, I'm not saying definitively he did have a particular thing to say, but I bring his wisdom in a meeting place with problems we face today. Basically, that's what this book is about. Because what I found over the long, long period of time I've been doing this work, and I originally thought it was just going to be like a little something on the side, when Matthew Fox convinced me to do my first book, what I found was that once people get over the shock that what Jesus was talking about was not really what they had been told in their childhood, either Catholic or Protestant in most cases, then they want to just know how to bring it more into their everyday life. You know, how to experience it more, how to live it. And so this book is basically aims to give some pointers in that regard. It's not a step-by-step process. It's not something you can put into a PowerPoint. I can't even do it in an online course in this way, which I now also do. But it just drops you in the middle. You open it. You breathe in your heart. You open it, breathe what your intuition wants to tell you for the day, and you'll find something. So it was written in a totally intuitive way, and there'll be a new chapter, a new thought, a new Aramaic seed word wherever you open, basically. So that's how the book is supposed to work. I often get questions about people who do centering meditation, contemplative prayer, things like that, as they're called, and they tend to have a rather narrow range of the Aramaic that they're using. So I wanted to provide them also with additional Aramaic, good Aramaic seed words to use, rather than something that St. Paul said when you want to curse the unbelievers. So, which is what's used. So anyway, but you don't need to know that if it's not of your interest.
So. No, it is of my interest.
To curse the unbelievers?
No, just what they use.
Well, you can look it up. It's in 1 Corinthians. But, you know. So this book was fun, and I did it after I had some surgical problems and, again, had to cancel this trip when I was supposed to come. When was it? 2023? I can't remember.
I think it was a couple of years ago.
A couple of years ago, yeah. So, you know, I had to stay home more, so figured why not do another book. And
do you have anybody to chat in Aramaic with?
A little bit. I have this one young student I'm mentoring who always wants to know about roots. You know,
is Aramaic commonly spoken in parts of the world still?
It's commonly spoken, but in a modern dialect, two particular modern dialects. Mm. Okay, we'll go into that part.
Awesome.
That's good. I'll take the question. So the Aramaic-speaking homeland, such as it is and or was, if you can visualize it, it is in what is now present-day eastern Turkey, northern Syria, and northern Iraq. Okay, those areas are some of the most conflicted areas in this whole area, not least of which because the Kurds also want this area. But Aramaic-speaking Christians, this is the old Assyrian, not Syrian, but Assyrian homeland. It's based around Nineveh. If you remember Nineveh from your, maybe if you had some ancient history or from the Bible or this or that, Nineveh is near modern-day Mosul. When I was just down in Chicago doing a seminar, actually I was in Madison, and a friend from Chicago came up who was born in Baghdad and was originally from Mosul, from this Aramaic-speaking homeland, and he's somebody I met 20 years ago. So there are still people there, but most of them had to leave because of all the conflict. And ISIS, of course, didn't like Aramaic Christians. They don't like Yazidis or anybody else as far as that goes. So most of them had to leave. Many of them did leave Turkey after the First World War, when the Western Allies carved up the Middle East for their own benefit. But the Assyrians were left out of that, and they didn't get their own homeland as they had been promised at that particular time. And the Ottomans, when the Ottomans fell, then the Ataturk pushed them out, and so a lot of them came here to the U.S. Southern California has a large Aramaic-speaking Christian community. I don't know if they're still speaking, but they're worshiping in Aramaic. There's on the north side of Chicago, there's a neighborhood that has a large number of Assyrian Aramaic speaking people, and they have an Aramaic Yellow Pages. And when you say, if there is still, maybe it's all online now, I don't know. It was a Yellow Pages when I was there last. But so these things are around. Sweden has a fair number of Aramaic speaking Christians. Southern France, as far as I know, and I can't remember.
Any parts of Israel or Palestine?
Not particularly, no. Not as far as I've found out. There was, occasionally you read you'll read these stories around Christmas or Easter. You'll say, we found a village where they speak Jesus' language, Aramaic, and it's in Syria, in Ma'alula. But, there are places all over the world where people speak Jesus' native language. And so this is a sort of sentimentalizing. There are different dialects, as I say, of the way people are speaking Aramaic today. No one knows exactly, including me, the way Jesus would have said his first century Palestinian Aramaic. I've made my best estimates based on the two dialects that Aramaic-speaking Christians use today when they pray. For instance, when they pray his prayer or they say the Beatitudes. And I add a little bit of ancient biblical Hebrew, which is different than the Hebrew that's spoken in Israel today, in certain particularities that are pretty important, actually. So it's more like I added a little bit of what's called modern-day Samaritan. The Samaritans speak a more ancient version of Hebrew than the other people in Israel, actually, than the people speaking what's called modern Hebrew. So, but that's maybe too much.
No.
Information.
That's great.
And Jesus' name in Aramaic is Yeshua.
Well, that's as close as we can get. You'll see Yeshua. It's basically the same. It's the same roots. I can say a bit about roots in a moment. It's the same roots as what you find as Joshua in the Christian translation of the Bible. But actually, ancient Hebrew has no J. That was a misreading. So whether it's Joshua or Jehovah or these things. You can imagine what happens when Jehovah's Witnesses come to my house. And I say, do you want to know how to really say, and they say, no, we'll go next door, It's like,
we're good.
The one time, they came, I gave them more literature than they gave me. They didn't come back, after that. Like that. But, you've got to have fun where you can have it. So, whatever. So Yehoshua, these are different forms. I use Yeshua. It's a simpler one to pronounce. But some of these Aramaic names at the time of Yeshua, some of them can be quite long. And I put them in a mystery novel a few years ago called A Murder at Armageddon, which is not a sort of blood guts sort of murder. It's sort of an Agatha Christie murder mystery set in first century Palestine. And Yeshua's there, and a few of his disciples are there, and Mary Magdalene's there, and all sorts of other good people, and somebody gets murdered.
Resurrected?
No, we don't get to that part. That's going to be in the next book. I was supposed to do this book several years ago, but then my publisher ended up doing all these other books, so... Anyway, eventually it'll get done. So anyway, so this is the new book, and yeah. You can use it as an oracle. You know, this is me pitching the book now. You can use it as an oracle. You can use it as a meditation a day. You know, that sort of thing. You can read it straight through. But, you know, give it time to sort of settle in. Don't try to read it all at once. Don't read more than one chapter a day. This is advice. You know. So just let it sort of gradually creep into your bones and enjoy it. So
you flip it open at some page. I have no idea what's within it.
We can do that.
Day of Holy Week, this very moment.
Yes, and we're in the middle of the Passover week, so which is ending on Saturday. I know. Well, here you go. I'm just because I'm doing an Easter retreat up at Bishop's Ranch. So let's see what we get.
By the way, the cover is really nice.
You like the cover?
I like the cover.
I was dubious, but anyway, I don't have much say over these things anymore, so.
The way the letters pop out in gold like that, it's nice.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, the light. Okay. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's enough. This is as good as any. We have some key words. Well, the title of this one is, if you open it, and I just did, Seeing Life with a Complete Heart. Mm-hmm. Seeing Life with a Complete Heart. So this is an important... I immediately start commenting, which is not what you want. The key words are Dad Kein Blebhon, wait for it, and Nesun La'alaha. I will say that this is from... Jesus is Yeshua's Beatitudes in Matthew. And it is the sixth Beatitude in Matthew. When you are guided or drawn to this day, feel your heart's deeply felt need to feel united and complete and to see your life clearly. Can be good. In the next Beatitude in Matthew, Yeshua offers the opportunity to feel completely within heart, seeing life lit up, outlined in light and clarity. This happens directly after we can feel our hearts overflow with love and thankfulness as part of the larger birthing energy surrounding us in our Ruha soul's womb. Well, the Ruha, I have to stop here immediately. You know, we have two different words for breath in Aramaic. One is the small breath, which is held within our body, as we call it today, within our flesh, within our individual self. And the other is the bigger breath of which we are a part. And these two words in Aramaic or in Greek, which I discovered also in doing the previous book, are translated inconsistently and mostly wrong. Also in the Greek. So I learned enough Greek to realize, oh my God, you know, they messed up the Greek translation too. Because just they couldn't see what was there. So Ruha is this larger breath. It's this, you can hear it in the sounds. And then the individual breath sounds like this, nafsha, nafsha. You feel these dense consonants, naf. It's like a head cold sort of thing. These sounds make a big difference. Early language is made from sounds, not from grammar, not from a dictionary, from the relationship between our sounds and what we feel around us, within us, at the same time. So there is a held breath, so to speak, held, nafsha, which is held for however many years we have here in this thing. And then there's the ruha, which is where we came from, where we're going. And that is a word that's better really translated as soul, which is how I do it in this book and the previous book. And the small breath is better translated as self. Now, you can read different authors. Don't get too confused. What Jung calls self as a capital S, C.G. Jung, that's Ruha. Clear. I've read enough Jung to know that. What Rudolf Steiner calls soul, is the small breath self.
It sounds more in Hebrew.
Yeah.
Ruach.
Nefesh.
And nefesh.
Ruach and
soul
nefesh.
And spirit.
Same. They're the same. It moves into Arabic in the same terms. You have nafs, small breath, ruach, bigger breath. This is why I had to learn them all, to sort of triangulate and make sense of all this, and a little bit of Egyptian and Coptic too. So, where was I?
Nefesh.
Oh, yes. Aruha, soul's womb. Here we can connect head, heart, and all our senses to perceive the larger life everywhere. Okay, so here's where the King James translates this. In case you wondered where I'm coming from. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. So immediately when we get pure in heart, you're thinking, well, I need to believe properly, I need to purify my heart, of all my sins and
go to church
and all of that, and then you get original sin layered on top of that as in terms of a doctrine, and on and on and on and on and on. Well, Yeshua's talking about he's talking about a clarity of heart, yes, if you want to take purity in that sense, but he's talking about a heart, a deeper sense than our surface of our heart, a deeper sense which is always completing. It's never done. We're opening the heart, we're deepening the heart, both of those are happening at the same time. That's what he's advocating anyway. So, one way to translate that is, I'm jumping in the middle, but in the introduction I go into some of the key words before you get into this. Full of joy, blissful right now, and this is the word tubei hun in Aramaic. This is usually translated blessed are, because we're in the Beatitudes, so this is the blessed are things. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Tubei hun dadkein blebon, those who are completing their hearts. Blissful are full of joy in the now, are those who find themselves completing, their hearts always completing themselves, becoming bigger, deeper. They shall be illuminated by the signs of reality wherever they look. So this is the part where you see God, so to speak. So there's a lot of, I had to learn Luther's Small Catechism by heart when I was growing up, so, I forgot what Luther makes of all this. Mercifully, I've forgotten most of what Luther said. But I remember a lot of King James Bible, which has been helpful, and I didn't think it would be when I was a child, but the learning by heart, the memory training was just decent.
Wow.
The words usually translated pure in heart, this is where I go into the roots and branches briefly, the words usually translated pure in heart are dad kein blebon, as I said, complete, full to overflowing, within heart. So wherever you have in something, it's also within something. That's very important. Jesus never asked people to believe in him. He asked people to believe either like him or within his consciousness, you could say. In other words, have the same trust, which is the word that's used for belief, not belief in concepts or creeds or this, but have the same trust as though I'm within you, you're within me, which is what he says in the Gospel of John. Ana oah pehun, he says at the end after he's resurrected. And he says it in other places too. So it's just a misplaced translation of a preposition. In can be within, can be among. It's that same one I mentioned earlier. So when he says pray in my name, it's as though he's saying pray with my atmosphere. Pray with my shem, with my light, within my name, so to speak. It's like a gestalt sort of principle, if you will. That's very important to know. So there are these multiple levels in Jewish mystical translation. It's called Midrash with a small m. Not the written Midrash of the rabbis, but the small m Midrash, where each word in Hebrew can have a number of different range of meanings. Aramaic's the same. Arabic's the same. It's a very, very these are very anti-doctrinaire, anti-fundamentalistic languages, because you can translate them in multiple ways. And it's not to say people don't, not to say people that don't ignore that principle. They do, clearly. But they're built in this more open, what I would call a nomadic consciousness, because ancient Semitic languages arise pre-agriculturally in this part of the world, when people before agriculture are hunting, gathering, traveling, you know, they are much more embedded in nature, and they're seeing the multiple levels of life around them, within them, around them, as I mentioned earlier. And so then when they begin to speak, and you could say in prophetic ways or in shamanic ways, the words that are spoken are also understood in these multiple, you could say this multiple more rainbow, not rain, well, rainbow's the wrong word, but, you know, a more multiple way of understanding. Hmm. Oh, yeah, which I do say here. Remember that ancient... I forgot what I wrote. I wrote this book. I wrote this book, 2 years ago, and the publisher decided to delay it till now. I don't know why, but maybe they thought it would be necessary. Remember that ancient peoples felt that the heart in our flesh was an expression of an unseen reality of perception, thinking, feeling, loving, willing. That's actually very important. I'll read that again. Remember that ancient peoples felt that the heart in our flesh was an expression of an unseen reality of not only emotional feeling, but perception, thinking, feeling, loving, and willing. That's very important. And this is as simply as I can put it. As noted earlier, there was no word for mind or brain in ancient Semitic languages. No word for mind. It's not to say there wasn't in other languages, but let's say even if you take Buddhist translations of the word mind from Pali or one of the early Buddhist texts, you could arguably also translate it as heart, because it's not split. You know, big mind and big heart are the same thing if you know your Buddhism, as far as I can say, in terms of the text, in terms of what the, say, Tibetan Book of the Great Liberation is pointing to or other books like this, it's the same. But in the ancient Semitic languages, there's really no word for mind. The thoughts are sitting, so to speak, symbolically or actually, on the surface of the heart. And so are the emotions. Thoughts and emotions are on the surface of the heart. There's a deeper heart. And Yeshua, in so many ways, especially in the Beatitudes, invites us to go deeper into them. I'm not doing very well reading here, am I? That's why I don't do book readings.
It's
fantastic.
This explains Yeshua's saying, usually translated, out of the heart proceed unripe thoughts, which is Matthew 15:19. The King James says, out of the heart proceed evil thoughts, murders, adulteries. You know, that's still true today, actually. Lies. But anyway, they're sitting on the surface of the heart, basically. So it's incumbent upon us, according to Yeshua, to watch the surface of our heart, be aware of it, make it realize that the individual self has many, many, many gifts. It has the gift of freedom. It has the gift of choice. Again, Steiner points this out quite a bit, but it's also true in terms of what Yeshua points out. Along with the more individualized self comes a sense of freedom, not to necessarily do what was done before, a sense of individual creativity, a sense of choice is really what it comes down to. So with choice, how do we choose now? And Yeshua points this out, particularly in his prayer and in other places as well. The words usually translated see God, they shall see God, are the Aramaic nehazun la'alaha, to have one's sight illuminated, as though in a lightning flash by reality itself. So Nazun is not like permanent light bulb on, it's like ba-doom, like a flash of lightning. Because that's what, you know, the ancient peoples would have experienced. It's like, da-doom. And then it's dark again. So all of a sudden you see clearly when the heart is clear. Great image. That's in the roots of the word Nazun.
Wow.
Yeah, I think it's pretty good. I don't know if I want to read more of this. But so anyway, each book has a couple of key words, a little bit of a, I don't know, I call it a build-up, a roots and branches section, which I borrowed from my Sufi book. I borrowed that format. Then a message for today. Anyway, it does work.
What's today's message?
Do you want to hear today's message? The part of this saying about seeing God can remind us of the Holy One speaking to Moses in Exodus 33, verse 20. You cannot see my face, for no human being can see me and live. For the ancients, the face, pana in Hebrew, represented the essence of a person's expression in time and space. So you have to think about that, the individual face. Again, the Quran says, in a couple of different places, everything is passing away. Kullu shay'in halikun illa wajaha, and that sometimes is translated as the face, although wajaha is actually the essence. But anyway, that's totally off the track, and it's not in the book. But in another place it says in the Quran, wherever you turn, there is the face. In that case, they are using the same root as is in the Hebrew, or Yeshua uses this root too, but not right here. Where am I? For the ancients, the face, pana in Hebrew, represented the essence of a person's expression in time and space. Gosh. The Quran later speaks about fana from the same Semitic roots, which is true, literally losing the outer face or appearance of something, with only the fullness of reality's beauty and power remaining. So, you know, there's the verse that I mentioned, and I give the Quranic verse. When a little of that fullness pervades our hearts, then our small self, the nafsha, has little choice but to, quote-unquote, get less, pass away, become transparent. Doesn't mean it dies, but if it does die, it's reborn in a different way. Has no choice but to pass away. In such moments, life passes before our eyes in clarity, as though in a flash of lightning, without any ability or need to impose our personal preferences on it. I think that's worth noting. Without any need to impose our personal preferences on it. Now, we have personal preferences, because that's the way our consciousness has developed, clearly. But there are moments when it's good not to have personal preferences. And that sometimes you can see clearly, and then you can pick up, you can become clear about what actually the proper choice, the proper preference will be in that moment. And Yeshua points this out in the following beatitude.
Is it like the shara?
Yes. There's the guy that's on it. That's the heart's GPS, the right direction. Shara. Today, of course, the conventional view tells us that no one can really know the truth. That's right. That's what we hear. Everything is relative points of view, nothing true or false. For Yeshua, when I view life from the flash of the heart's ray, what is actually happening before me becomes completely clear. It can happen. It does happen. You've all had it happen. Along with clear sight comes Malkuta, which he uses, is another one that's based on that. It's in his prayer, it's in the Beatitudes. Along with clear sight comes Malkuta, the I can, revealing what is mine to do now. That's a very important question right now. What is for me to do now, given all the whatever going on around? Perhaps life is calling you to a pilgrimage on Yeshua's Beatitude way, to first feel the heart of personal preferences, then allow it to fill up and overflow with thankfulness and love. Complete in heart, we can now see and think clearly. And this is the proper use of the surface of the heart. Clearing our heart may happen in an instant, in a moment of deep need, or it may take several steps. However, none of these can happen if we simply drift along, dosing our way through life, because that's more comfortable than following the way Yeshua points out. Right. So, the dozing or dosing. You know. Was it indulgence of the writer? You know, if you can, exactly. And let's see what I had for a contemplation. We can do a little bit of that. And I never do these the same way twice, so. Okay. Well, anyway, as I say, I'll do it a little differently. But it uses the key words that I mentioned at the beginning. Sorry. Let's breathe. Let's just feel our breathing settling in. I mean, you can have eyes open, half open, whatever you like, or just rest a bit. I'm placing one hand lightly over my heart. I'm feeling the rise and fall of the breath within my flesh. This is, you could say, my personal breath, the breath that forms the basis of who I think I am, actually, my all these self-images that I have, you know, my roles, my responsibilities in life, all that lovely, those lovely things that we came into this life to explore. I'm just breathing, feeling the surface of the heart. And for a moment, we'll try to follow the breath more deeply. And by more deeply, it's as though we're falling backward into the body, behind the heart, behind the surface of the heart, which is maybe the questions we want to ask, or you could say the challenges that we came into the bookshop with, or what we're going to do when we leave here, all those beautiful things. We just let the breath go deeper, fall backward. Let's breathe with the word Ruha. This is this larger breath of which we are a part. It's as though it's around us, it's underneath us, it's above us. It's a bigger breath of life. And we feel for a moment that we are within a bigger heart now. Blebhon is the Aramaic word, but you don't need to know that. Unless it's helpful for you, we are within this larger heart, which is part of this larger breath, if you will. So we're breathing in Ruha, we're breathing out Blebhon, within heart, or Lebha, you could use that more simple word. Ruha has those lovely open sounds, the ooh sounds, the ha. And the Blebhon has more of this sense of an innerness, a deep innerness, that also has a rhythm. It has a sense of motion, which is where our emotion comes from. It has a sense of moving through something, through time, through space, but also bringing us back into rhythm. So breathing in Ruha, breathing out Blebhon, within the heart, within your heart. We let go of the words, we're just breathing with a feeling of this deeper heart, a deeper breath, a door opening to a bigger life. The deeper heart is not where thoughts and emotions are. It's deeper. It's really the doorway to what Yeshua might call the heaven of our heart, where we feel our sense of interconnectedness with each other, with beings around us in nature. And then the heart also can become a way that we perceive. We can see through the heart. We can hear through the heart. We can smell, touch, taste, sense through this deeper heart. It is this deeper, you could say, heart that is seeing, smelling, touching, tasting, hearing through us. Nesun Allah. This is the heart of reality that wants to see and perceive and live a very unique flavor of life through each of us individually. What if we could see through our hearts for just a moment? What if we could make choices from that place? Okay, let's release the Aramaic and all that. But our breath and our heartbeat continue, reminding us that we can always just go back. Even without Aramaic, it's as close as our own breathing, close as our own heartbeat. We can just dive in, and Yeshua's words can help point the way for those who feel close to these words or close to this being. Amen, amen, amen. Okay, thanks for that, friends. And I think what we can do is, what else do I want to say? That's all I want to say. We can take some questions. We have questions, questions, questions. Yes, you there in the back, standing by the counter.
So thank you for your words. So, you know, as a Christian, I guess one of the core tenets is I am the way, the truth, and the life.
Yep.
And so I wonder from your background and research, do you believe that a belief in Yeshua is a foundational or critical piece to this greater interconnection and awareness that you're discussing, or is that sort of not a necessary
thing? It's necessary for me. It's necessary for the many people who have, I know over the years, have benefited from my work and who feel Jesus as a companion of the heart. When Yeshua says, Inanna, Urha, Shrada, Wachai, he's saying this to his students in the Gospel of John toward the end of that, it's basically what is his last talk with him, more or less, before he goes to the cross or whatever happens then. And the formula, as I've pointed out in Revelations of the Aramaic Jesus, is Ina, Ina. He's connecting his small self, his Ina or his Enna, with the source of that. Okay, so we have a gift of self, and he points this out, a gift of the I, not the I, because we have two of them, but the gift of an individual I, a self. No one can call you I except for you. I can call me I, but you can't call me I unless you're a Rastafarian, and then we're talking about the I and I. But anyway, that's off the track. So Yeshua was talking. It's right on. Yeah, I think so. But, you know, only a few people get that in Europe because the Rastas are not that popular in Europe. But anyway, so he says, and this is a wisdom saying, Ina, Ina. And before this, what's gone on before this? We'll unpack the whole thing. He says to his disciples, I'm going. After he does the foot washing and he says, love one another as I've loved you. He says, I'm going. And you will be able to find me in... After I've left this flesh, you will be able to find my consciousness, and that will provide a place where you can orient. It's a touchstone. You know, you can, don't worry, you won't see me in the flesh, but you can touch me in this other world. So this is where it says, you know, I go to prepare a place for you. The place is not a physical place. It's a state of consciousness, if you will. You can go there and orient yourself. You can find your way. It's like he leaves a vapor trail for us, as I wrote in a book. And now I'm forgetting who is it. I think it's Philip asks him, or Thomas. You know, once we get into that other place in the other world, because again, remember, other worlds were a reality for people at his time. It wasn't just like all here horizontal in this, many of them had negative experiences with beings in the other world. And I also point this out in Revelations of the Aramaic Jesus. This is why there were so many people that he had to heal from these different demons or these different spirits, and they have different names in Aramaic too. So, you know, going into the underworld was not always a great experience for people when they had a traumatic everyday experience. And why would they have such a traumatic everyday experience? Well, because they were being oppressed by empires for hundreds of years. First the Babylonians, then the Assyrians, then the Greeks, you know, and then the Maccabees kick out the Greeks, but the Maccabees start to fighting amongst themselves, and one branch of the family calls in the Romans. Hello, Romans, can you come and help me out for a few months? Well, the Romans come to stay. The Romans always came to stay, you know, but go figure, nobody knew. It's like any present-day empire. You know, you invite them in, they come to stay. You know,
what were they thinking?
Yeah. Well, but anyway, whatever. So the Romans are there then, and the Romans had their taxes. The priests in the Jerusalem temple, who were charged by the Romans with keeping people quiet, they had their taxes. And then the local sort of potentates, the kings, the sons of King Herod the so-called Great, who was a psychopath, they were also taxing people. And by the time you get through with all of this, you know, nobody had anything. The underclass was so huge, it was even almost even bigger than today, or maybe it was bigger. It's, you know, we could get that. We could get to that place today quite quickly, actually. So after you'd given them all you had, then they would come and take your son or your daughter into slavery, or take you into slavery, or whatever. So this is why most of Jesus' listeners were living in this very, very, not post-traumatic syndrome, they were in the trauma. They are in the present trauma. So these people, and this has been shown, I mean, I don't want to go into all the depths of this, but as was proven by another scholar who I favor, whose name is Philip Davies, wrote a whole book about Jesus as a healer and this whole background of what was going on. Of course people were experiencing what we would call liminal realities, you know, being between the worlds, which was, you know, at one point was called schizophrenia and this or that or the other thing, but now we talk about liminal states. So they were experiencing liminal states, not always in a positive way. And that goes without saying. So Yeshua does his healing within this context. Back to John. So when Philip or Thomas, I can't remember, asks, you know, well, once we get there, how will we know it's you on the other side in the unseen world and not some imposter? Which can happen, and if you've done any of that sort of traveling, it can happen. How will we know it's you? And Jesus says, well, you know, you're seeing me now. You know, aren't you getting who the real I is in here? Who the real I is here? The Ina, because he's been talking to them in Ina terms throughout the whole Gospel of John. I am the bread of life, you know, I am the light of the world. Then he also says, you are the light of the world, just so they don't get mistaken about that it's only him, and on and on and on, the different sort of so-called I am statements. Actually, he could not have said I am, because there's no word for am in Aramaic, or for is or are, because the being verbs don't exist at that time. In Aramaic or even in ancient Hebrew. Now, I know you're going to ask me about Exodus, so hold the question. So, I will finish this phrase. And so, Jesus says, well, you know, get it. He says, you know, if you're seeing me, you're seeing the one who sent me. Ina. And so, I think it's Thomas then says, well, you know, can't you just show us directly? And Jesus at this point says, urha, that is the path connecting your small self to the one who gave you that self is the path. Washrada, it's a sense of the right direction. Wachay, it's a sense of the energy to help you travel the path. So it's the path, your heart's sense of the right direction, and it's the energy, the chay, the life energy to travel on that path. This is what gives it to you. Okay. And then he says, and this is what, where you have a mistranslation, in the King James says, no one comes to the Father but by me. Well, what he says is actually, in my experience, what I've just told you is the way that people go. And if you're going to go and go to the source, the breathing life of all, it is in this way, connecting the small self to the one who gave you that small self, and that will show you your path, it'll show you the right direction, and it'll give you the energy to go, to travel. And so, again, you have a preposition that's mistranslated in the no one comes to the Father but by me, and really it is more like, my understanding is, no one, you could say, goes, no one travels, no one experiences the other world in a healthy way, except in the way I've just told you. Okay. Now, does that mean it's not Jesus? Or does that mean... And people always want to say, okay, it's just that, and it's not Jesus personally. But Jesus has said in a few sentences earlier that his presence will be there to help. Hmm. It'll be there as a connecting place. So it's a both and. Hmm. It's almost always a both and. But not usually in the way it's interpreted, mm-hmm. I would say. Mm-hmm. But it's a both and. So thank you for the question, and sorry for the long answer. So I answered... I get there in the end. Yes, and you, finally, we had a second question. It's good.
So, I've been reading Desert Wisdom.
Oh, yeah, okay. Go for Desert Wisdom, aficionado.
The window works.
There's the Aladdin's cave of everything.
Yeah. And so, when you were doing the Beatitudes, and this is, I just read this today, and the one of the translations is, ripe are those from their inner wombs.
Yes. Tubehun lam rahmane, dalehun nehun rahme. You hear those lovely breathing sounds? Dalehun nehun rahme. Beautiful. Rechem, like Hebrew. Rahme, rahmane in Aramaic. Rahman and Rahim in Arabic. Ancient roots sounds that continue almost uninterrupted over tens of thousands of years. These are what I call mother sounds. I've written another book about this, but it's not done yet. The mother sounds that unite Hebrew, ancient Hebrew, Aramaic, and Arabic. And so this is one of the key ones. This is the fifth beatitude. And what was your question?
I've got 1,000 of them, but come on. Whatever you're saying is the right thing.
I don't mean to blind people with science or with linguistics, but again, the shape of the beatitudes is the breath going deeper. He starts out, Tubehum lemeskeni bruch tilhonimao kutadishmaya. I just led a group through this in an online course. Tubehum lemeskeni bruch. So those who realize that their ruha, their big breath, is really all that they're holding on to. That's what you came into life. And you took your first breath in your body, so to speak. We'll call it body just to make it simpler. And when you leave, that breath that you've been breathing in this body will go on and keep traveling. When you realize that your breath is your only real possession, then the universe opens to you. So this is the one they translated, blessed are the poor in spirit, for, to them belongs the kingdom of heaven.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a bit different. Again, wherever you see kingdom, read queendom, because the word in Aramaic or in Greek is feminine. Should have done queendom, minimally, if they want to use a feudalistic, translation.
So much for the patriarchy.
Yeah. But yeah, almost all the feminine genders words were translated either neuter or masculine from the Greek. Of course, the same in Aramaic, because Aramaic has a wide variety of gender. Semitic languages do, so I don't know, but I mean, maybe that's not the important part, but you start with the breath, and the breath goes deeper. It's like Genesis 1. It all starts with breath. Ruach Elohim goes into the unknown, the swirling, tohu abohu, and fabulous, and then light happens, so it's the same thing. Yeshua follows the same procedure in the Beatitudes. You start with the breath, this big breath. It goes deeper. You feel what you haven't been feeling. The mourning, the grieving, the confusion. That's in here. All these Beatitudes are in here, by the way. I'm not trying to sell you the book, but I did.
Go ahead.
You really should.
Yeah, there's less to return then,
Buy the book.
Whatever. Buy it for a friend. Christmas is coming. No, Easter is coming.
Easter.
You could hide it under the eggs or whatever, when you're celebrating the goddess and all that. But anyway, yeah, so the breath goes deeper, you feel what you haven't been feeling. That in itself is a relief. And then some softening happens in the third beatitude. With the breath, we become more open to resources around us from nature, natural healing within us. That goes deeper, and then you could say, then he comes to what I would call the center point of Matthew's Beatitudes, which is really about, back to the same subject, he always goes back to feel what's really now. And he has this beautiful, beautiful word in Aramaic, chenuta, with a K-H, chenuta, which is translated as righteousness. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst after righteousness. What does righteousness mean? Oh my God, you know. It's used as a club sometimes to beat us over the head as children. You wouldn't be righteous. You know, when you sin, you're killing Jesus. This is what they told me. I don't know about you. But anyway, whatever. So righteousness is chanuta. It's the heart's honesty. And inner honesty leads to outer justice. When you come to this clarity of heart, you cannot lie to yourself. And so it's much more difficult, or really becomes impossible, to lie to other people. And then you treat people, you could say, more like your natural human self would treat them. I think it's honesty is the center point of this journey through the Beatitudes. I'm trying to think of Oliver Wendell Holmes, jumping quickly, one of the American transcendentalists said, whatever evil is done, it begins with a lie.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's rampant lately.
You know, so I think he uses the metaphor that a lie is like the handle of the shovel that's shoveling the shit. But he's more polite than that, because he's a, you know, early 20th century transcendentalist New Englander. But that's basically what he says. So, you know, here we have it in Yeshua, you know, so practice, there's a chapter in here, it says, practice today only telling yourself the truth. And avoid, at all costs, lying to someone else or saying what you know is not true. It can get to be a habit. In the Gospel of Thomas, Yeshua's disciples ask him, what diet should we observe? And, you know, what holy days should we observe? And, you know, all yada, 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 the whole thing. He says, just do this. Don't lie and don't do what you hate. You know, for there's nothing hidden that will not be revealed. You know, nothing hidden will not be revealed. Nothing that's covered will remain without being uncovered. Again, there's some Gospel of Thomas I redid in Revelations of the Aramaic Jesus. So order it from your favorite bookstore, like here, and they'll have it in for you within, whatever, a day or two. So the honesty is the center point. Then, tubayum mam rachmane. So the breath has gone down, 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 clarity, and then it comes down to here. The lower heart, the deeper heart, racham, the womb. The womb, another word for this, you could say, this type of love, this compassion that the Beatitude speaks about is an unfolding like giving birth. When you really love another person who is your close racham person, it's like you help them give birth to themselves, and you're also giving birth to a new sense of yourself. That's not everybody. That's not what the word that he uses for love your enemies. There he uses a different word. But it is one where he talks about greater love has no person, racham, than to put your individual self aside for your racham, your racham me, which is what's translated as greater love has no man than lay down your life for your friend, which is a totally different meaning, because it's not life. He's talking about you set aside your individual self, sense of self, for a person who is your deep racham companion in life. So anyway, may it be so. Okay, other questions which don't involve, you know, half an hour of exegesis? Yes, over here, please, madam.
Could you just speak a little about the idea that you brought up, that appearances in the ancient, that appearances were less important than the sound, how the I mean, you've been mentioning it
all
the way through what you're saying, but just for example, I think you gave like tuning a stringed instrument. It's not so much what the string looks like, but what it sounds like. And so how does that work together with the breath and the sound, and in the beginning was the word, and let there be light, and all of that stuff?
Too many smart people have showed up tonight. No, these are all great questions. Yes, that's all true. So, appearances are what we live with, right? There's a wonderful book, if you're interested in this whole subject, by Owen Barfield called Saving the Appearances. Again, Owen Barfield, close friend of C.S. Lewis. A lot of what C.S. Lewis and Tolkien get is from Owen Barfield, both in The Hobbits and also in Lewis, although Lewis was ambivalent, C.S. Lewis. Saving the Appearances, write it down. You'll be up for it. Be patient. The first 50 pages is slow going, but then you'll be fascinated. Because he speaks sort of like I'm talking, but not in Aramaic. So, yes, the appearances, we're more involved in that, shall we say, over tens of thousands of years. Music is less... Do you know what an Aeolian harp is? It was an ancient stringed instrument that was played by the wind. And so the wind would blow through this harp and you would hear melodies. And where you were and when you were and what the wind was doing and who you were would determine what melodies you heard. So it's a little bit like that, using the stringed instrument metaphor. Now, of course, we tune things. So tuning happens very gradually, since we'll go with the musical metaphor. First we have the very open sounds, where you have the untempered music, overtones, harmonics, music of Hildegard of Bingen, and where's the expert on Hildegard of Bingen? She's here.
You're calling me an expert.
Oh, there she is. She's the expert. She does Hildegard singing groups. So this... you know, Gregorian chant, this sort of music, native music, not tempered music. By tempered, I mean where you're not playing chords. Overtones and undertones. Her husband is the master of overtones. But I'm not revealing things from your community. But anyway, but yes, he is actually the capital M. I don't care if you use like the word or not, he is. So, gradually, over hundreds and hundreds of years, there's an innovation of playing notes together. These are called chords. Are you with me?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
This is not only about music, this is about human consciousness. This is the same, it's happening at the same time that human consciousness is emerging from a late stage of this being embedded with each other. This is the sort of medieval times. We become more individual, music becomes more individual, and gradually more individualized and more professionalized. Art moves from, you could say, the non-perspective ancient art, which we find, for instance, in Japanese woodcuts or Persian ministers, where there's no vanishing point. Art proceeds from that to perspective. Again, it's about distance, individuality. All this is going on, 15, 1600s, words start to mean something different. Spirit divides from breath. Whereas in Latin, spiritus means breath and spirit, means spirit and breath together. Pneuma, P-N-E-U-M-A in Greek, is the same. So you have these words separate out. And there's a whole bunch of them that do that. Saving the Appearances is a guide to that. So we're talking about this same trajectory of human consciousness that's going on, and we're in the middle of it. We are smack dab in the middle of sort of like the choice point of what do we do next as a human species. How are we going to live? How are we going to live? Yeshua says, "Vela tachlan lenesuna ile patsan min bisha." Let us set us free from unripeness. We know that unripeness happens, that we're not always acting at the right time at the right place. Set us free from that. Vela tachlan lenesuna. Help us remember. Help us remember where we came from that bigger breath, and where we're going to that bigger breath, and that we're part of something much bigger. Help us remember, and help us, you know, set us free as best as possible from unripeness, realizing that the individual self is capable of unripeness. That is evil. So this is, you know, lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. So, which is okay, but except it doesn't say lead us not. It says let us not enter. Okay, even in the Greek. So Pope Francis pointed this out a few years ago, and I said, Pope Francis was only 20 years behind me. I said, anyway, but he's working in Greek, so, you know, I cut him some slack. You know. And then, you know, he had Laudato Si, so, you know, he's good by me. Yes, please.
Yeah, this is a question about practice.
Yes.
Yet I'm not aware of Jesus talking a lot to his followers about experiential practice. And what do you understand about what his practices were that led to his realizations?
Mm-hmm.
And did he or did he not teach practice, not just giving teachings, but practice about how to realize?
Understood. Yes. Gotcha. Well, starting in my 1999 book, Hidden Gospel, I'm all over that question. Because from what I can see, prayer is practice. Because Aramaic only has a word that means prayer and meditation. It's both together. So when Jesus goes up in the hills above the Sea of Galilee and says he prayed all night, he's not mumbling words in a cave somewhere. When he says, pray, b'shemi, he's thinking about meditate, contemplate within my Shem, within my vibration. And it goes on and on and on. All of his prayers, all the Beatitudes, these are all practices that he's giving people. Now, he doesn't have to say, do this practice, like I do in these books, because human consciousness already was partly remembering, and they were just only partly forgetting. What we today call, and I know this is controversial, what we today call spiritual practice was not needed in archaic times. 100,000 years ago. People were already embedded. Practice arises, as do various stories, and the axial age religions arise to help people remember what they were starting to forget. And so, we do practice. Great, I'm doing practice. You're doing practice. Let's do practice. Absolutely. Doesn't mean we don't need practice. Means we need it all the more. And we can choose to do practice to get our heads together and our hearts together and figure out what the hell we're going to do. You know? As a individually and also as a species. So.
But in other words, at that time, that wasn't needed as much because it
was... No. The things he was concerned about helping people with were tuning into the other world in a helpful, healthful way, not in a way that would cause them problems. I'm saying this softly. But if you read the old Gospel of Mark, it's all about all these problems that people encountered and how he heals them, so to speak, heals them, and what's going on with all of that and all of that. So, yeah, he doesn't have to talk about practice, but he offers all these things. And, you know, here I am, whatever it is, how many thousands of years later, and I'm saying, look, this is what he's talking about. But I had to study Hebrew, Aramaic, and Arabic to get there. And you could say, in one view of my life, I wasted a heck of a lot of time in academic study just trying to say, look, friends, this is what's actually going on here. And I had to, you know, and I still do, I got people coming at me from all sides, theologically, historical Jesus people, this and that and the other thing, and, you know, they don't bother with me anymore because they know I can out-argue them. Not to say arguing is a spiritual practice, but, you know, that's what I've been doing.
Thank you for...
It makes my life fun anyway. But yes, please practice. And you'll find many practices in my books that I believe that Yeshua was pointing to just for us. Because now we need practice.
Uh-huh. My understanding of the story I've heard is that Gandhi once said that he didn't become Christian because he didn't see Christians being Christians, and he meditated on the Beatitudes every day.
I did read that too.
And
I saw that somewhere.
So I'm thinking that maybe what you're discovering in the Beatitudes is a place for us to go back to and possibly help us on that nonviolent journey, like
I think so.
Like
yeah,
Gandhi was trying to lead us.
I think go back to it and then go ahead. Because often what I say is, you know, after people have read my books for a while, then you're sort of free, really. I mean, even if you haven't read the books for a while. Because different people come to the same place from different... I find this more and more, since I've done work online for COVID and talked to a whole bunch of people, and people write me letters and this and that. People are coming in with all sorts of new life experiences, also of real experiences of the other world being real. And you can come at this... I come at this from Jesus because I'm helping people sort of like take off the, free yourself, take off your chains, people of the world. No, you know, but you can come into the same place from a number of different avenues. I do feel that Yeshua is pointing to some very, very important things, and the fact that Western culture was built around an aberrated view of who he is, mm-hmm. is sort of psychically, if you will, important. And so I have a little bit of, I'm sticking with what I'm doing, mm-hmm. but I also value what other people do. Mm-hmm. The two most prevalent illusions today are that only the self exists mm-hmm. and only the material reality exists. Mm-hmm. And that's what's being taught in school. So once we start to acknowledge that, okay, there's more than just me, and there's other realms, whether you want to call that quantum or the zero-point field or whatever, I don't care what language you use, it's mm-hmm. lovely, you know, go for it, you know. We need more of that, you know. Because if we had more of this and not so much of this,
right.
there would be more sense of right treatment, as Yeshu would call, the inner honesty, the outer justice, you know, in our lives. So, hopefully. Well, I think we're just about running up. I can sign some books. We'll take one more question, and then I'll sign books, and I'm out of here.
So I started with the Purge of the Cosmos, you know, many, many years ago.
God love you.
And there was a transmission experience out of soaking that up. And flash forward to Revelations of the Aramaic Jesus. I'm buying copies of that and turning on my friends, and they're not getting into it.
No, it's too much. It's too much Aramaic.
Yeah.
That's why I wrote this book.
So this is a good...
This is better than Prayers of the Cosmos.
Good.
The only reason I don't recommend Prayers of the Cosmos is because my publisher, 5 years after I published it, which was in 1990, was bought by Rupert Murdoch, who owns Fox and like that, and he fired everybody that I knew at Harper. And he eventually took the black-skinned Aramaic Jesus off the cover, which some of you have, and I signed a couple of the old copies. They put some anodyne sort of sun-sized or sunrise on it and change the title without telling me and, you know, and on and on. So I recommend this book as your best starter book. It has the whole of the Aramaic prayer and the Beatitudes and also the Beatitudes in Luke in it. You see, that was my like, take that, Murdoch.
Absolutely.
No, but it served a good purpose too. So anyway.
Thank you for that recommendation.
Can I ask one last question?
Please.
So I'm just I'm really grappling here. And so
grapple away.
When you look at all the great religions, you know, Buddhism, Islam, Judaism, with what you've learned now, do you find that there is a common thread that connects everything together as opposed to makes one more true? And I'm just really curious.
You know, I'm less concerned about the common thread than I am about accepting that diversity within this bigger sense of reality. So for me, I go from a bigger sense of non-dualism, if you will, mm-hmm. that the non-dualism is not just like Cheese Whiz or Velveeta, where it's all like one thing, but you have these varieties of flavors, these varieties of ways, and that is the real big picture that also Yeshua is pointing to.
Right.
So anyway, that's my personal thing.
So you don't find anything in the other religions that you find incompatible with your own growing, developing.
It depends on what level of historical religion we're talking about. Right. But yes, when you get down to the people, the visionaries, mm-hmm. who brought these things, there's pretty much agreement. What happens after that is history,
yes.
or theology, or, you know, Islam has a different name for it and all that. So, yeah. Anyway, thanks everybody. Thanks for coming.
Mystics breathe together. So I'm going to give Carl the last word here.
Well, I was going to give you the last
word. Okay. Well, let me remind you what was said earlier. There's a donation bowl over there. There are books to purchase over here. There's a gentleman, the author, who can sign those books for you. And
there's a GoFundMe.
Oh, yeah. Thank you so much.
Don't forget that.
Yes, that's
important.
That's
for these guys. This bookstore needs to continue.
That's right. So the GoFundMe is Look for Many Rivers Foundation. And that's it.
Don't lose your bookstore.
Thank you so much. Yes. That was really wonderful.
Thanks, Rob. I had fun. I always have fun here.
Well, I'm glad.
I think it's all the herbs and things. Get it my, and the incense. I'm between the incense and the Kelsey and whatever.